You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We continue now with Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian's conversation with Lucy Nusebi, the founder and director of Middle East Nonviolence and Democracy, and Michal Miller, an Israeli peace activist from the Truman Institute for Peace at Hebrew University. We pick up with Miller describing how life has changed since the start of the Second Intifada almost 3 years ago.
Well, of course, there's the increase in security measures, and I don't necessarily call them security measures myself personally, but rather because they don't really protect anybody. The measures that have been implemented mostly just disrupt life. They don't truly protect us from anything, and in fact, they've begun to endanger us because we now suspect everyone. It's very uncomfortable to be a person that suspects every single person that you come across that they're going to hurt you. It's unhealthy. It's unhealthy to project that onto the other person. It's unhealthy to have that inside of you. I think that the danger that the Israelis feel, that we feel, that we live and experience, I myself have been in attacks, is a result of the occupation. And I don't support the one-sided blame that goes on for Israeli security. Israeli security is linked hand in hand with what is going on. There is nothing to say beyond that.
Mm-hmm. You say that you've personally been in or around when attacks have taken place. I mean, we don't have to go into the details, but do you know of anyone personally who's been killed either in Israeli military incursions or bombing attacks?
Yes.
And how has that influenced your work as a peace activist?
Well, initially, it's shocking and horrible and horrific. There's no excuse for it. There's nothing to say. There's just anger and frustration and sadness. But at some point, you have to turn that into motivation to make the situation better. That if nothing will change this, if this doesn't change it, then nothing will. And that we have to use this as our fertilizer, because these are the strong emotions that it brings up, and we need to use it positively.
Mm. What about you, Lucy?
Well, I'd like to endorse what Michal said, that, you know, a lot of what is done in the name of security, I think, makes things worse. And obviously, the basic problem is the occupation, is the control that Israel has maintained over every aspect of Palestinian life. I think when you cage an animal, the animal starts to go mad eventually. And if the Israelis insist on caging Palestinians, they're now building a wall that's 8 meters high. That's very high. That's higher than most houses, I think, in the Washington area. They're building this wall on the pretext that it will give the Israelis security. I think that this is completely psychologically wrong, that what they will do is just create more security problems like this, that you cannot mistreat and cage a population and not expect them to try to get out and fight their way out if necessary.
Speak about this group that you founded, the Middle East Nonviolence and Democracy, MEND.
It works primarily with education. We've worked a lot with schools. It was founded 5 years ago to empower Palestinians and to really introduce the philosophy of nonviolence as a way of life and to encourage people to look for alternatives to violence. And we worked, one of our best projects has been with Sesame Workshop. So we have been in charge of all the educational materials that promote tolerance mm-hmm. between Israeli and Palestinian children. And we work with women's empowerment, partly again through the use of video training and active nonviolence training. And in the past year and a half, particularly, we have concentrated on training in active nonviolence and in working to promote nonviolence within the community. We have produced a radio soap opera to promote nonviolence among Palestinian youth, and we have started training groups of political leaders in active nonviolence in a way so that they are now setting up centers from which they will train other people and work within their community. And of course, we also work a lot with trauma and counseling, because there's a terrifying rate of trauma among children. And we've set up about 9 community centers where we also give counseling and trauma treatment.
Mm-hmm. Mikhail Miller, you work with this group, Maxim Watch, which in English is Checkpoint Watch. It's a women's organization that monitors human rights at the military checkpoints in the West Bank. Speak about exactly what it is that you do.
We're about 150 members, and we go on shifts twice a day, every day, 7 days a week, what we call the rush hour, you know, the morning and the afternoon when people are going and coming to and from work and their regular daily routine. And we try to assist in the movement of the population. We monitor what happens with the soldiers. We write reports. We get involved. We're all women, as you indicated. There's a special force that can be empowered by women, that we are a little bit less threatening than a group that includes men as well, that we can relate to people differently. We're less aggressive, perhaps, and we get involved with assisting people. We help them. We do our best. But, you know, it's mainly also to offer another face to the Palestinians. The Palestinians in the West Bank, they see the soldiers. That is their face of Israel. They don't know that there are other people out there who do care about them and who are concerned about the suffering that they're going through and do know about it. And it also serves as a way that we can document from a civilian point of view what is happening. And we can't really attack the policy and the law at the checkpoint, because that's not what we're there for. If you want to change the law, you have to do it in the proper place. But what we can do is ensure that it's being followed. We know what the laws are. We know how things need to be handled. We know what they're allowed and not allowed to do. We write it down, and we challenge the soldier when it happens. Some of our women have been arrested a couple of times. People have been hit. But mainly, we use this as an opportunity to bring to the attention of the military what it looks like from a civilian's perspective of what's going on. And we send our reports. We ask for meetings with government officials. We don't always get them. But sometimes they do give us an audience.
As an Israeli Jew, how are you treated generally while you're doing this work by both Palestinians and members of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces?
The organization was founded at the beginning of the Second Intifada. And at first, they didn't know who we were, and they were very, forgiving is the word with us, very flexible with us. But then when they started to realize that we were not there to support them directly, it became a different story. But over time, we've kind of learned to work with each other in the way that we still get abused violently by them. And accused of everything under the sun, and vicious, all of the frustration. It's kind of another role of that we play is that all of the frustration from the soldier and from the Palestinian at the checkpoint comes out on us because they know we're there to listen, and the Palestinians don't have anybody else in the Israeli public that they can talk to, and so they recognize that we're there to help them, and they let us know what they think of that. For good and for bad. And that's okay. That's really okay. We need to hear that. And the Israeli soldiers let us know what they think of us criticizing them, and that's not okay. But
mm-hmm. When you prepare these reports of mm-hmm. different abuses that you witness, are these reports generally regarded sort of with a higher standard because they're prepared by other Israelis?
Well, we designed the organization to include to be very exclusive, let's put it that way, that it's only Jewish women, mm-hmm. it's only Israeli women. Now, we do bring almost on every shift people who are visiting, people who want to observe, and that's fine. But the core itself, our legitimacy, is that we are regular members of society that want a democratic country that treats all of its citizens well, that supports the values that we think a democratic country should, and we have our strength from that. And so we have had to make some very difficult choices about, for example, not including Palestinian women with Israeli citizenship. And it's mostly to protect them because the soldiers would not be treating them the same way that they treat us. And we can't take responsibility for that. There are other ways that those women can or people can affect social change. But the checkpoint is such a volatile place that we need to be very selective. And there's also another thing about how they treat us is how we treat them, that we all have a lot of frustration and anger that we come with, and that when we see what is going on, it's sickening to us as human beings. And what we have to do is try to channel that into a productive avenue, but it's really not easy. And some people become a little bit confrontational, and they become a little bit aggressive. And so it's the situation. We have to remind ourselves constantly, the occupation is what is causing all of this, all of it, not us.
What do your Jewish friends think about your peace activism?
Well, as it is with, I think, most people who start to become more heavily involved with this type of work, the other friends that really disagree tend to slip away. I still have problems with people who care about me because it is very dangerous, and we do things that, you know, we are civilians. We don't have protective gear. We are in danger of you know, somebody who wants to make a political statement by kidnapping an Israeli. You know, all of these things, they are realistic. But we say that there's a responsibility for the citizen of Israel to take this into their own hands at some point. Now, we're not going head-to-head with the army. That's not what we do there. But, you know, four women standing at a checkpoint, helping, supporting, negotiating, documenting is what we can do.
Do you have real hope that this nonviolent path and the work that specific work that each of you is doing can bring about change?
I think it has to bring about change, and I think this is the time that it's really crucial now that you know, everyone all over the world is worried about security and aware of how connected we are, especially over security issues, and that nonviolence, if it's given encouragement in the context of this struggle, can really make the world a better place for everyone.
Speak about the stage that we're at right now in the peace process. How hopeful are you, Mikael?
Recently, we had a poll that came out that indicated that majority of Israelis supported two-state solution, but these are also the same people that elected Sharon back into office. So you have to ask yourself, what is that about? Well, it's about fear. It's not about denying Palestinians their existence anymore. It's about, rather, that how do we build this correctly that we can ensure our own needs within this process, that we are not destroying all of our own values and aspirations as a nation while encouraging somebody else's. And unfortunately, Sharon doesn't necessarily share those views. And so it's kind of a contradiction that in the Middle East we're used to contradictions, but this is a very dangerous one. And so our responsibility is to get involved, to take ownership, to have institutions of cooperation, NGOs and other social organizations within the society working to support the Israelis in their goal for national, you know, for statehood and for their own security, and that they're not going to lose their home and they're not going to lose a way of life, and helping them to help the Palestinians build their own. And that way it will work.
One of the criticisms that we've often heard from analysts in the international community looking at this situation from an outsider perspective is that part of the problem that this peace process has been unsuccessful, you know, as of yet, is that on the Palestinian side that there haven't been any strong Palestinian leaders. People have criticized Arafat. Now they're looking at Mahmoud Abbas, saying that he represents sort of a different echelon of Palestinians as he's sort of wealthier and has access to resources outside of the area. Do you see the issue of Palestinian leadership as a problem?
Personally, I don't see it as a problem. I see the whole people really just wanting to get out of the miserable situation which they're in. I think it takes courage to make leadership decisions, and that there are going to be some very difficult ones if the peace process continues, but that it's almost immaterial who takes that role at the moment. I think it's the people, the grassroots level, that are really going to make the crucial difference. That peace doesn't work just at the political level. People have already made this mistake in the past. It needs to be woven at all levels of society. And so the more tightly and strongly it's woven, the less it matters who actually leads.
What's the next step? Where do you think we should go from here?
I think we have to work partly dealing with the questions that Michal mentioned, like the fears of the Israeli public. I think this is one crucial element, because I think that we need to get the public on both sides to take their future in their hands, and that this is a matter of changing some mindsets and really building up trust. The polls have shown that I think 72% on each side consider lack of trust one of the basic problems. This is something that can be dealt with and that can be worked with, and that's a significant majority that could take a peace process forward. I think this is really the next step, to work with the people and bring them on board and give people a chance.
Michal, what do you think is the next step?
I agree with Lucy that the two societies have to take charge of this, obviously with their leadership, and their leadership has to recognize and have to include their voices in the decisions that are being made. There's a lot of good work going on out there, but there's a lot more space for it. The message is not getting out to the Israeli public, that there is still a tremendous fear among Israelis for their own security needs, for their own national needs, for the continuation of a Jewish state. And that must be addressed, and it must be spoken that the state-building process for Palestine does not negate a Jewish state for Israel. And that when we're talking about securing for Palestinians their rights and rights of return and rights of land and rights of water, it does not, you know, disqualify Israelis from having rights. And I think that this is where the Israeli leadership has been, maybe intentionally, maybe not, getting the message out to the population, that they still feel like it's a zero-sum game, all or nothing, and that there's no room here for some type of cooperation, a real cooperation. We're going to have to take a real critical look at what is happening and to understand it from a different perspective, because otherwise this really could continue. I don't think that there is an end to it indefinitely. And so we have to at some point take it out of the hands of people who are not willing to say the things that we're saying here and to move it forward.
Michal Miller is an Israeli from the Truman Institute for Peace at Hebrew University. She's also an active member of Maxim Watch, a women's organization that monitors human rights at military checkpoints in the West Bank. Lucy Nusebi is the founder and director of MEND, Middle East Nonviolence and Democracy. She and her Palestinian husband have been living in occupied Jerusalem for the past 25 years. Miller and Nusebi spoke with Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian.
Finally, as the occupation of Iraq enters its fifth month and the Pentagon sets its sights on North Korea and other so-called rogue nations, we're going to take a step back in time today to listen to the words of U.S. Marine officer Schmedley Butler. Butler served in the Marine Corps in the early 1900s, earning two Congressional Medals of Honor. He's become something of a Marine Corps legend, not only for his personal courage, but for the energy he put into avoiding bloodshed when it was possible to achieve his aims in other ways. He offers these thoughts on who wages wars and who's responsible for stopping them. His words are read by New York activist poet Chris Brandt.
War is a racket. It always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is the only one international in scope. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. A racket is best described, I believe, as something that is not what it seems to the majority of the people. Only a small inside group knows what it is about. It is conducted for the benefit of the very few, at the expense of the very many. Out of war, a few people make huge fortunes. In the World War, a mere handful garnered the profits of the conflict. At least 21,000 new millionaires and billionaires were made in the United States during the World War. That many admitted their huge blood gains in their income tax returns. How many other war millionaires falsified their tax returns, no one knows. How many of these war millionaires shouldered a rifle? How many of them dug a trench? How many of them knew what it meant to go hungry in a rat-infested dugout? How many of them spent sleepless, frightened nights ducking shells and shrapnel and machine gun bullets? How many of them parried a bayonet thrust of an enemy? How many of them were wounded or killed in battle? Out of war, Nations acquire additional territory if they are victorious. They just take it. This newly acquired territory promptly is exploited by the few, the self-same few who wrung dollars out of blood in the war. The general public shoulders the bill. And what is this bill? This bill renders a horrible accounting. Newly placed gravestones, mangled bodies, shattered minds, broken hearts and homes, economic instability, depression and all its attendant miseries, backbreaking taxation for generations and generations. For a great many years as a soldier, I had a suspicion that war was a racket. Not until I retired to civil life did I fully realize it. Now that I see the international war clouds gathering as they are today, I must face it and speak out. There are 40 million men under arms in the world today, and our statesmen and diplomats have the temerity to say that war is not in the making. Hell's bells! Are these 40 million men being trained to be dancers? Not in Italy, to be sure. Premier Mussolini knows what they are being trained for. He, at least, is frank enough to speak out. Only the other day, Il Duce, in International Conciliation, the publication of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, said, and I quote, "Above all, fascism, the more it considers and observes the future and the development of humanity, quite apart from political considerations of the moment, believes neither in the possibility nor the utility of perpetual peace. War alone brings up to its highest tension all human energy and puts the stamp of nobility upon the people who have the courage to meet it." Undoubtedly, Mussolini means exactly what he says. His well-trained army, his great fleet of planes, and even his navy are ready for war. Anxious for it, apparently. There are others in Europe, too, whose saber-rattling presages war sooner or later. Herr Hitler, with his rearming Germany and his constant demands for more and more arms, is an equal, if not greater, menace to peace. Yes, all over, nations are camping in their arms. The mad dogs of Europe are on the loose. In the Orient, the maneuvering is more adroit. Back in 1904, when Russia and Japan fought, we kicked out our old friends the Russians and backed Japan. Then, our very generous international bankers were financing Japan. Now the trend is to poison us against the Japanese. What does the open-door policy to China mean to us? Our trade with China is about $90 million a year, or the Philippine Islands. We have spent about $600 million in the Philippines in 35 years, and we, our bankers and industrialists and speculators, have private investments there of less than $200 million. Then, to save that China trade of about $90 million, or to protect these private investments of less than $200 million in the Philippines, we would be all stirred up to hate Japan and go to war. A war that might well cost us tens of billions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of lives of Americans, and many more hundreds of thousands of physically maimed and mentally unbalanced men. Of course, for this loss, there would be a compensating profit. Fortunes would be made. Millions and billions of dollars would be piled up by a few. Munitions makers, bankers, shipbuilders, manufacturers, meat packers, speculators. They would fare well. Yes, they are getting ready for another war. Why shouldn't they? It pays high dividends. But what does it profit the men who are killed? What does it profit their mothers and sisters, their wives and their sweethearts? What does it profit their children? What does it profit anyone, except the very few to whom war means huge profits? Yes, and what does it profit the nation? Take our own case. Until 1898, we didn't own a bit of territory outside the mainland of North America. At that time, our national debt was a little more than $1 billion. Then we became internationally minded. We forgot, or shunted aside, the advice of the father of our country. We forgot George Washington's warning about entangling alliances. We went to war. We acquired outside territory. At the end of the World War period, as a direct result of our fiddling in international affairs, our national debt had jumped to over $25 billion. Our total favorable trade balance during the 25-year period was about $24 billion. Therefore, on a purely bookkeeping basis, we ran a little behind year for year, and that foreign trade might well have been ours without the wars. It would have been far cheaper, not to say safer, for the average American who pays the bills to stay out of foreign entanglements. For a very few, this racket, like bootlegging and other underworld rackets, brings fancy profits. But the cost of operations is always transferred to the people, who do not profit. The World War, rather, our brief participation in it, has cost the United States some $52 billion. Figure it out. That means $400 for every man, woman, and child in America. And we haven't paid the debt yet. We are paying it. Our children will pay it. and our children's children probably still will be paying the cost of that war. The normal profits of a business concern in the United States are 6, 8, 10, sometimes 12%. But wartime profits, aha, that is another matter. 20, 60, 100, 300, and even 1,800%. The sky is the limit. All the traffic will bear. Uncle Sam has the money. Let's get it. Of course, it isn't put that crudely in wartime. It's dressed into speeches about patriotism, love of country, and we must all put our shoulders to the wheel. But the profits jump and leap and skyrocket and are safely pocketed. Let's just take a few examples. Take our friends the DuPonts, the powder people. Didn't one of them testify before a Senate committee recently that their powder won the war, or saved the world for democracy or something? How did they do in the war? They were a patriotic corporation. Well, the average earnings of the DuPonts for the period 1910 to 1914 were $6 million a year. It wasn't much, but the DuPonts managed to get along on it. Now, let's look at their average yearly profit during the war years, 1914 to 1918. $58 million a year profit, we find. Nearly 10 times that of normal times. And the profits of normal times are pretty good. An increase in profits of more than 950%. Take one of our little steel companies that patriotically shunted aside the making of rails and girders and bridges to manufacture war materials. Well, their 1910-1914 yearly earnings averaged $6 million. Then came the war, and like loyal citizens, Bethlehem Steel promptly turned to munitions making. Did their profits jump? Or did they let Uncle Sam in for a bargain? Well, their 1914-1918 average was $49 million a year. Or let's take United States Steel. The normal earnings during the five-year period prior to the war were $105 million a year. Not bad. Then along came the war, and up went the profits. The average yearly profit for the period 1914-1918 was $240 million. Not bad at all. There you have some of the steel and powder earnings. Let's look at something else. A little copper, perhaps. That always does well in war times. Anaconda, for instance. Average yearly earnings during the pre-war years 1910-1914 of $10 million. During the war years 1914-1918, profits leaped to $34 million per year. Or Utah copper. Average of $5 million per year during 1910-1914 period. Jumped to an average of $21 million yearly profits for the war period. Let's group these five with three smaller companies. The total yearly average profits of the pre-war period 1910-1914 were $137,480,000. Then along came the war. The average yearly profits for this group skyrocketed to $408,300,000, a little increase in profits of approximately 200%. Does war pay? It paid them. But they aren't the only ones. There are still others. Let us not forget the bankers who financed the Great War. If anyone had the cream of the profits, it was the bankers. Being partnerships rather than incorporated organizations, they do not have to report to stockholders, and their profits were as secret as they were immense. How the bankers made their millions and their billions, I do not know, because those little secrets never become public, even before a Senate investigatory body.
New York activist poet Chris Brandt doing a reading of U.S. Marine Officer Schmedley Butler's infamous speech entitled War is a Racket. Thanks to Anthony Sloan for production assistance with that piece. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T. from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammond of KPFA and Gil Kulik of Search for Common Ground. A special thanks tonight to Kirby and Karen McLaurin. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.